Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and it is my pleasure and privilege to present to you this, by the way, is Side A of For the Record, program number 749. We are speaking with John Loftus, a man I consider to be a genuine American hero, the author of, among other titles, way back in 1982, The Belarus Secret, then The Secret War Against the Jews, and Unholy Trinity, both co-authored with Mark Arons, The Witness Tree, and Valhalla's Wake, which we will speak about, and most recently an updated and uncensored version of The Belarus Secret, America's Nazi Secret. John Loftus, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thank you, Dave. I've been away for a while. I'm recovering from some spinal surgery, but it's good to be back.
Well, I'm recovering from major jawbone and mouth surgery, a tooth infection spread, and so I had 15 hours of surgery, and I'm still talking like Elmer Fudd. So,
I think you notice a difference, but nobody else does.
No, it's there, but it's still the same old me with the same old blues, and so or news
good
as
to
it
have
were.
You back.
Yeah, well, it's good to be back. And by the way, if listeners who have not heard the program are interested in some of the more recent developments and my take on them, the news and supplemental section of the Spitfire List website has about 2 years worth of blogging material. I was blogging almost as soon as I got out of intensive care, and there's tons of information in there. John, in recent weeks, we have been deluged with stories about the NSA leaker Ed Snowden, who has been disclosing that the National Security Agency and the British GCHQ have been hoovering up, vacuum cleaning massive amounts of electronic communication, and no doubt you were shocked to learn that there is gambling going on in this establishment.
You know, and it's a funny thing, but I've been saying this stuff for years, way back when I wrote The Secret War Against the Jews. There was a very controversial passage that was censored out of my book, then put back in. I don't think that people understand that 90% of what Snowden is saying has been out there. Of course, we vacuum up everything electronically in any digital form anywhere in the world every day. The argument is that's not what violates his civil rights. It's only until someone, quote, targets it, that they actually listen to it, that's when your, you know, Bill of Rights stuff comes in, your Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable search and seizure. Well, targeting means someone has to actually sit down at a computer and type your name in, and then it'll search through the trash can of all collected things and pull out your talks. I wrote in The Secret War Against the Jews that what's been happening is, in order to evade the little requirement for search warrants, which apparently some people think is just a typo in the Bill of Rights, that we've been having the British Secret Service uses the NSA's computers to bug American citizens, and the American NSA uses British computers to bug British citizens. So each side can truthfully swear they're not spying on their own citizens. They're not. They're just swapping illegally obtained information. That's been going on for an awful long time. It's the big loophole in this intelligence sharing stuff.
John, so we've been talking about that in our interviews since June of 1995 on
absolutely.
And off.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, what Snowden apparently was shocked that this was happening, and I think he made one valid point, that there really is not enough supervision. There is supervision. I mean, we have both congressional supervision in the form of reviews by the two intelligence committees, and we have judicial supervision in the terms of the FISA court. But he's saying that needs to be tightened up, and I agree with him there. I think he was stupid to do what he did. He should have gone to Congress. You know, and as I told Jonathan Pollard, you know, if you'd just gone to Congress with this stuff, you would have been a national hero. And now you're simply going to be a target of prosecution.
One of the things that I find interesting, again, this information has been on the public record. You and I have spoken about it. I've written about it. And being based here in the Silicon Valley, the belly of the beast, so to speak, I can tell the listening audience without qualification that not only the Internet, but all of these related functions, their smartphones, all of this stuff, their social networks, are inextricably linked with military and intelligence-developed technology. So again, I'm shocked that there's gambling going on in the establishment. But over in Europe, John, they are really shocked to learn that there's gambling going on in the establishment.
You know, Dave, among my many security clearances was a cosmic clearance for all NATO top secrets. Everybody in NATO, everybody, was involved with wiretapping and recording what their own citizens said. The Americans have the most protection. The Europeans are absolutely, well, next to Russia. You know, next to Russia, that doesn't even make a pretense of having privacy and civil rights. The European nations all monitor what their citizens say.
There was when, in the late 1990s, there was a flap about the Echelon and Menlith Hill facilities. Again, a logical Internet development of the phone call vacuuming, and a European parliamentary report from September of 2001, published, I should say, in September of 2001, said a number of European countries have the same capabilities.
Of course. I mean, it's technology makes it very simple to record conversations, emails, digital faxes. Anything that is in electronic form is recorded and saved. Now, what's legal? Well, a phone book obviously has metadata. It has information about your phone number and where you live. If you add to that your telephone bill, the numbers of the people you are calling, you can get some very good intelligence information from that. So the intelligence agencies are saying that metadata, phone book data, we don't need a search warrant for that. Well, I kind of think they do. Now, believe me, I've dabbled in metadata myself. There was a terrorist case down in Florida, Sammy Alarion, that I got involved in. And what we did was, a buddy of mine, we sent out advertisements to all of Alarion's supporters saying, we want you to try our international calling card free for 90 days. And we hope you'll sign up with us in the future. Well, one of the idiots actually used our card. So we became, for a brief period of time, the phone service for Al-Qaeda. We became the Ma Bell of terrorism. Because once one person volunteered to have us be their phone company, then we were able to buy the phone bills of everyone that he called. And from the metadata, we were able to make a logistical map of all the terrorist support cells in the U.S. This is about 8 months after 9/11. And it was so successful, you know, at first when we gave it to Northern Command, and they were a little skeptical, then they ran our list of phone numbers through their computer, and it lit up like a Christmas tree, that we had found a way to identify logistic terrorist cells in the U.S. And Northern Command went crazy. They said, my God, next to North Korean nukes, this is the most important project we had. And from our metadata, they then were able to successfully obtain search warrants. The FBI took credit, of course. We never did get that $1 million reward for justice they promised. But because someone volunteered to have us be their phone company, that was a way we legally found a way to get to the door. Now they're trying to say, well, without a person's consent, can we collect metadata? I don't know. I don't think so. It's like a pen register. When you get crank calls, you can call the police, and they can get a warrant to put a pen register on your phone to record the phone numbers of anyone that calls you. And that's a good way to trace down crank callers or obscene callers. But I think there's a balance between the needs for security, the needs for privacy, and we're going way, way too far, Dave. In terms of tipping the balance towards security.
The drift away from democracy has been going on for a long time, and I have to say that at times I find this entire thing, aside from the individuals behind Snowden and this whole thing, who actually track back to the far right and explicitly Nazi elements, that is on the posts I have done on the News and Supplemental, Americans have not been paying attention to what has been happening with regard to the dissolution of their democracy. You talked about Samuel Arian, and we're hearing all about whistleblowers and reporters having their phone records subpoenaed. Journalists, in my opinion, are very much like a flock of birds. When one lands, they all land. When one flies away, they all fly away.
Yeah, they're not reporters. They're repeaters.
They really are.
Repeat what another reporter has said, yeah.
The fourth estate has metamorphosed into a fifth column, in my opinion. One of the things that struck me, John, in your investigation of Samuel Arian, it led directly to the Operation Green Quest raids of 2002 and big political names. Some of the people who were complicit have names like Norquist, Rove, and I read about this in a full-page article first in the Wall Street Journal of April 18th, 2002, and nobody made a peep about this. I wonder if you would tell us a little bit about citizens.
Develop that for us. There were Arab extremist groups in the United States, and they tried to burrow their way inside law enforcement. And they found the easiest way to do that was through politics. They told Grover Norquist and Karl Rove, the Bush's chief of staff, that they would get out the Arab vote in Florida to offset the Jewish vote in Florida, and they would deliver the entire state of Florida to Bush in his first run for president. And they did, maybe a little hook and crook. But the people who made that promise were people like Samuel Arian, who are now convicted terrorists. I mean, Rove was an absolute idiot. They made a deal with the devil. And, we have people, Al Arian has his picture taken with President Bush, and now he's a confessed terrorist. And now we're trying to get Al Arian. He's constantly being held under house arrest in Washington after having served a prison term because he won't reveal where the money came from. Well, I know where the money came from. You know where it came from, Dave. It came from the Saudis.
Sure.
From Bandar Bush, as the president called him. The Bush family is so involved with their Saudi friends, it was a huge scandal. Now, the Saudis are backpedaling furiously. They realize that funding the Muslim Brotherhood and these other, Arab Nazi groups was a huge mistake. So the Saudis now are trying to fund, and they did fund, the overthrow of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, while Qatar was supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. But, this whole part of history, that we had an American sort of royal family, the Bushes, who were in bed with these obscene ultra-right Islamists who are, from what I understand the Islamic religion, and I have many good teachers that are helping me, that they are practicing a heresy, that Wahhabism or Salafism, as it's popularly called, was condemned as a heresy against Islam more than 60 times before 1900.
One of the points that I want to emphasize for the audience, again, is people are just flapping their wings in what I would regard, frankly, as faux outrage over so much of what's going on. What people really should have been shocked about was in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, to find out that the highest, most powerful political figures in our country, including the family of the president, were deeply complicit in the deep political events that resulted in that. John, very quickly, In the recent Boston Marathon bombings, a lot of these same connections emerged, and it turned out that the mosque in the Boston-Cambridge area at which the Tsarnaev brothers, the alleged bombers, worshipped, had been founded by Abdurrahman Alamoudi. He was the principal person in that. Tell us about Abdurrahman Alamoudi and his benefactor, Grover Norquist.
Yeah, Grover Norquist is sort of this chief of all wingnuts. And he has this very influential study group where everyone who wants to be a riser in the Republican Party has to come kiss his ring in order to be anointed by the conservatives. And Alamoudi was given money by Grover Norquist to set up this Islamic Institute, and they did things like, pick Muslim chaplains for American prisons, Muslim chaplains for the armed forces. And, of course, Alamoudi was himself a terrorist. He was actually caught being the bagman for money put up by Gaddafi to assassinate the man who is now the king of Saudi Arabia. So Alamoudi is a world-class terrorist who was, a step and a half from the White House. He had total access.
And it was he who founded the mosque at which the Tsarnaev brothers were worshipping. John, we have spoken so often in our interviews, and you have written extensively about an institution we have already touched on in this interview, the Muslim Brotherhood. I wonder if you would briefly synopsize that organization's history, and then in the time since we last spoke, the phenomenon of the Arab Spring manifested itself, bringing the term Muslim Brotherhood, or awareness of it, to Main Street, USA, and elsewhere for the first time. Synopsize, give us the history of the Brotherhood briefly,
sure.
and give us your thoughts about the Arab Spring and its aftermath.
Okay. In 1928, there was an Egyptian who wanted to marry the Nazi party with Islam, and called his group the Muslim Brotherhood. He was a devotee of Adolf Hitler. The Muslim Brotherhood was a functioning arm of Nazi intelligence during World War II. Many of them were war criminals. And when the war was over, none of them were prosecuted. They were hired by the British Secret Service by a guy named Kim Philby, who turned out to be a communist double agent. But the Arab Nazi movement was huge. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood alone had 750,000 members. The British wanted to use them as sort of a fifth column to crush the infant state of Israel. And later on, the British sold them to Alan Dulles, who became head of the CIA. And so Dulles rescued the Muslim Brotherhood when they were being expelled from Egypt, and he moved them to Saudi Arabia, where the Saudis run them. So we had Dulles's idea was that we'd have a group of Arab Nazis as a proxy army to fight Arab communists during the Cold War. Completely asinine, but that's what they did. The last time we took the Arab Nazis of the Brotherhood out of the closet was in Afghanistan, when we had them recruit people in America, young Mujahideen freedom fighters, to drive the Russians out of Afghanistan. Now, this was one of those programs where we're in 89, we won the war, the CIA washes its hands and come home, and the Muslim Brotherhood is still out there organizing in several nations. We revived the Arab Nazi movement. And at the same time, there were the liberals within the intelligence community determined to end America's long-term policy of supporting dictators as long as they were loyal to America. So the Arab Spring was run by a charity in Washington, D.C. And if you don't believe what I'm about to tell you, you can actually go through the secret State Department cables and WikiLeaks and search for Freedom House. That was the name of the charity. And you will see that they were debriefing this group of students that had been brought to America and taught how to organize peaceful revolutions, nonviolent demonstrations, all to coincide 3 years later at the exact same time of the Arab Spring in 2011. the Arab Spring was funded openly with $20 million annually from Congress through Freedom House to train young people on how to coordinate uprisings. And so we are the Arab Spring.
Now, the upshot of the Arab Spring in its initial manifestation was that, of course, Egypt has many different political factions and people of different orientations, like most countries. And the liberals, the people who wanted an open democratic society where women would be free to walk around without headscarves and without being in fear of rape, and religious and ethnic minorities could have freedom of religion as well as political expression, they were ultimately shunted aside by the Muslim Brotherhood, which literally manipulated the political process, came to power, and began doing their thing. What are your thoughts about how the initial result of the Arab Spring was compared to how the perhaps intenders of this within the U.S. intelligence system envisioned, what they envisioned?
Well, I think this was, understand that the movement to train democracy wasn't really so much as an intelligence project, is run by retired intelligence people. A friend of mine, a former director of the CIA, was head of Freedom House. Okay, but this is a charity to train people in democracy. I loved it when the Muslim Brotherhood was elected. I loved it when Hamas was elected. Because as soon as you take an ultra-right-wing group and put them into power, nothing destroys like success. That these people didn't believe in democracy, they were lying when they said they were going to have a multifaceted cabinet and protect all religions, and their lies caught them up. And, of course, they wrote a constitution that had no impeachment clause in it, no recall elections, no parliamentary vote of confidence. So what the people did is they simply signed a petition, and the petition contained more signatures to throw out the Muslim Brotherhood than had voted on all sides in the last election. So my sense is, by rough justice, the people of Egypt, via a very democratic process, the only one they had available, impeached their leadership. And I think that you will probably see a much better, a more pluralistic constitution emerge from this. But I got a lot of criticism from my friends for cheering that the Muslim Brotherhood was elected, because I predicted in writing in my columns that they would collapse, and indeed they have.
Go ahead, John.
Well, they've come out and saying, look, we never believed in democracy in the first place, so now we'll never do it again. So the true face of the Muslim Brotherhood has emerged, and they're not democratic at all. Now, our State Department had a little mutiny. Our State Department was on the side of the Muslim Brotherhood since the 1940s. Back when the CIA was hunting Nazis, the State Department and the British were recruiting them. And so, for example, when Obama sent word to the State Department, go tell Mubarak he must step down, there must be democracy in Egypt, the State Department sent an emissary named Frank Wisner Jr. He was the son of the original Frank Wisner, who recruited the Muslim Brotherhood.
That's Frank Wisner of OPC fame.
Right. He was Alan Dulles' assistant. And for a while, Frank Wisner was head of OPC until Alan Dulles came in from the cult. But so his son went to Egypt and betrayed the president. Didn't tell Mubarak to step down. He said, stay where you are. It'll all work out.
Do you think that there were factions, because in some of our programs, interviews, including For the Record 706, you described the evolution of sort of a binary intelligence system and State Department dating back to the schism between genuinely democratic forces and Alan Dulles, Frank Wisner Sr., and now possibly Jr.
Brief perspective, Alan Dulles was Dewey's campaign manager, and President-elect Dewey, because everybody knew he was going to defeat Harry Truman, promised Alan Dulles he'd be the first head of the CIA. So Dulles, at with the request of the British, Kim Philby, began recruiting Nazis and bringing them to America, while the CIA and Truman were still out hunting them. When Truman was reelected, State Department was in a quandary. They talked with their friends in the Justice Department, my old agency, I'm embarrassed to say, and they committed a constitutional mutiny. They protected Nazi war criminals in America so that when, you know, a Republican would finally be elected, when Eisenhower came in and Dulles and his brother took over State and CIA, that they would merge these Nazi programs supposedly with the CIA. Well, it never happened because, you know, the CIA was still trying to prosecute Nazis and the OPC was trying to hide them. So we've had two CIAs in America, one that worked for the Republican Party and one that worked for the Democrats.
Do you think that manifested itself in the actual unfolding of the Arab Spring itself?
Yes, I think so, because the real CIA, the mainstream CIA, said, we support democracy. It's stupid. The State Department policy of backing dictators is wrong. For good or ill, people must choose the leaders they want. If they want Islamic leaders, we have to grin and bear it. So they organized the Arab Spring, and State Department opposed it. So we had two conflicting foreign policies, two conflicting intelligence policies at the same time.
I remember, and we're almost out of time on this side, as this was unfolding and people were celebrating democracy, the impending democracy, there were back-to-back columns by Muslim Brotherhood leaders in the op-ed pieces in the New York Times, lying in their teeth, basically, saying it was a democratic organization, nonviolent, anti-colonialist, and I after I cleaned up the vomit off of the floor,
Generation Nazi group, literally. That's what the Muslim Brotherhood is.
In a post about the unfolding of the Brotherhood reign in Egypt, I quoted one of the liberal bloggers saying that Morsi was a textbook Islamic fascist. John, we're almost out of time on this side. Tell us about upcoming projects, websites, etc., and then we'll continue inside too.
I've been writing a column for a Jewish magazine in New York, of all things, AmiMagazine.org, and I'm collecting all my columns, and they will be out in electronic form, my first attempt to have my books published by myself. And I think it'll be a bit fun. The book will be called Spy View Volume 1. I've got enough written for three books now, and basically it's an intelligence professional's analysis of the secrets behind today's headlines. How to make sense of what you're doing, Dave.
All righty. Very good. And by the way, for the benefit of listeners, everything I have ever done, my entire life's work, all of the audio files, all of the written descriptions, blog posts, including 2 years' worth since I had the surgery, are all available at spitfirelist.com, are downloadable for free, including many interviews and text excerpts with our guest, who is John Loftus, and we are concluding side one of For the Record program number 749. This is being recorded on July 21st of the year 2013. For my guest, John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.